Hi, this is Eugenio Duarte. I hope you enjoy the interview you're about to listen to. If you do, or if you have ideas for books you'd like to hear about on the show, let me know. Go to my website, EugenioDuartePhD.com, and click on Contact to send me a message. And now on with the interview. Hi, this is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Yulia Beltiu, editor of the anthology Immigration in Psychoanalysis, Locating Ourselves, published in 2016 by Routledge. I'd like to tell you about my guest. Dr. Beltiu grew up in Germany as the daughter of recent Greek immigrants and came to live in the U.S. as a young adult. She's a graduate of the New York University postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis. She's presented nationally and internationally on the topic of immigration and identity. And in 2013, she received the Patrick Lane Award of the Psychoanalytic Society of the postdoctoral program for her work on immigration and psychoanalysis. Yulia Beltiu is also an adjunct supervisor at the doctoral program in clinical psychology at City University of New York and maintains a private practice in New York City. Welcome, Yulia.
Thank you for having me, Eugenio.
Our pleasure. So let's start with why a book on immigration and psychoanalysis. What does psychoanalysis have to say about the immigrant experience?
Yeah, immigration is a life-altering experience, one that encompasses language, culture, dreams, limitations. It has a before and an after, a pre-immigration identity, a post-immigration identity. So it's an experience that takes a tremendous amount of adjusting to. And psychoanalysis, so in psychoanalysis, that would be part of someone's identity that needs to have a part in our understanding of what we're grappling with when we work with patients, immigrant patients. Psychoanalysis has in its history the experience of immigrant and exiled analysts, and it can help us examine the discontinuities in self-experience. It helps connect us to our dreams and yearnings, our desires. It helps us mourn losses to find a home within, so to speak.
So within the larger umbrella that is psychology and among all the different theoretic orientations, under that umbrella, you feel like psychoanalysis might be particularly well-equipped to understand the immigrant experience, to help immigrants understand their own experience?
Yes, I do believe that because there's, you know, psychoanalysis is interested in transgenerational experience of trauma, of identity, of certain themes we bring with us. And that's really relevant for the immigrant experience. There's something about the patterns and where certain experiences originate from psychoanalysis really tends to in a way that many other forms of psychotherapy don't. And so I believe that psychoanalysis can help us understand that that sort of historicity of our experience.
And what does your subtitle mean? Your subtitle is Locating Ourselves.
What I mean by that is finding a home within. There's a fragmentation or sort of a, you know, Hazel Ip calls it an amputated self because of this sort of major shift in our self-experience when we leave a place behind, leave a language behind, leave a social context behind, and move to a different place. So to find a way to, I guess Bromberg would call it, stand between the spaces, building bridges between past and present, between communities that are, you know, in different places, to sort of be able to carry that within is a way of locating ourselves.
I feel like it might be useful to be clear about terms. You know, what defines an immigrant? Who counts as an immigrant?
I've left that really open, but because, you know, there are different terms. There's émigré, which sometimes sounds like it's a different class of an immigrant, a voluntary immigrant with means. I've sometimes in casual conversations have asked people about their immigration experience, and they are sort of like, well, we're not immigrants, because what they associate with immigrants is someone of a lower socioeconomic status. Then there's, of course, the distinction between voluntary and forced immigration. I think that's a really important one. That makes someone a refugee or someone living in exile. That's often a situation where political circumstances or economical circumstances too force people to leave in order to find a place with greater safety, with a means to survive.
So I'm wondering if it was challenging to put together a book on immigration, because there are so many different types of immigration. People leave their countries for another country under lots of different sets of circumstances, no?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And people have asked me if I wanted to, you know, participate on panels on mass immigration and the refugee crisis that is, you know, part of our world these years, these days. And I have shied away from that because I do feel there is a particular specialized angle on forced immigration and the trauma that comes along with being a refugee that I feel other people are much more involved in actually doing refugee work than I have been. You know, I think many psychoanalysts in private practice don't actually work with refugees. They work with immigrants. Meaning they work with people who have already settled, who are not in the status of, trying to get residency status in the U.S. or in another country. They're not working with asylum seekers. There are some of us who do that work as well. But many people we see in our private practices are not refugees. And I think they're really good books on people who've done this kind of work and are very attuned to the realities that refugees are facing. My mother is a psychotherapist in Germany, and she has worked at a refugee center for many years. So I'm very aware of her work having sort of nuances to it that I don't practice in my private practice with international transplants.
Mm. You know, and a word that I'm familiar with a lot, given my history as the son of Cuban parents and grandparents, is the word exile. Mm-hmm. Because many of, you know, my family and many from their cohort immigrated to the United States and settled there. But by the time I was born, they were settled. And so I wonder if there's a difference between a person who is exiled versus a person who is a refugee versus a person, like you said, who had a more seamless transition from one country to another, and if their psychological experiences differ.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I think that, Cubans who left Cuba, after Batista was overturned, they had a set of experiences that they had in common, and they may have not felt that it was truly chosen for them to leave. They had to make a choice, but also they didn't choose the new realities of the political situation in Cuba. And so there's a way of having to mourn a place that that you once knew that has fundamentally changed because of the political structure having changed, that leaves a different set of experiences behind, complicated feelings about your place of origin, and also when you cannot travel back and forth because of the political sanctions, there's a level of loss that's different for someone who can easily, you know, hop on a plane and fly and visit relatives. I do think that this experience of someone being exiled is a very different experience. There's also, there's often a wish to conserve some of the culture that one had to leave behind. That's why immigrant communities become of vital importance.
You're saying that in situations, and I think this is happening a lot with Venezuelans as well, to the degree that it's becoming more and more unsafe to travel back to Venezuela. Are you saying that when return to the home country is not a possibility, that that might be associated with a greater desire to recreate or to preserve, as you say, aspects of the home country in the new country?
Absolutely. I think that a cultural community in the new country takes on a whole different meaning when you cannot travel back, and certain things that are comforting, you know, to find them is very meaningful, you know, be it foods, be it language as sort of a place to resort to.
And customs, I imagine.
Yeah, and customs, religious communities, cultural customs, yes.
So I'm imagining that some of these questions around who is an immigrant and what are the different kinds of immigrant experiences out there presented itself when you were putting together the book, because this is an anthology, so you've brought together several authors to write about this. And were all of your contributors immigrants, and how did you go about deciding who you wanted to include or what kind of immigrant experiences you want to represent?
Yeah. Well, when I developed the book proposal, I put together a list of themes that I felt were connected to the immigrant experience. So immigration as psychological opportunities, the effects of immigration on self-experience, language in the, you know, the meaning of language in immigration, otherness and immigration, sexual otherness, name changes, trauma, mourning and melancholia. And I contacted immigrant analysts, many of whom had already written something about immigration. So I had come across their papers and was curious, basically wanted, contacted them and asked them if they'd like to write something for this volume. And some of them hadn't published anything yet, but I just knew that they were interested in the topic and had touched on it in other presentations.
Are all of the contributors immigrants themselves?
Yes, all of them are immigrants themselves.
Do you feel like non-immigrants can write about immigration, and can non-immigrants treat immigrants in psychotherapy?
Yes, I believe that non-immigrants can treat and do treat immigrants, and they can also contribute. Actually, the panel that led to this book was one in 2013 at Division 39. I presented, you know, a form of the paper that ended up being in the book together with two people who had been born in the States, and their parents were immigrants. And these two women were also really interested in the immigration experience and have written about it. And they could have been part of this book as well. So I did not, I thought there was something meaningful about including immigrants, but I also reached out to some non-immigrant analysts who have written on this topic.
Is there something that non-immigrant analysts or psychotherapists need to hold in mind when working with an immigrant patient in order to work effectively?
You know, I think the idea of bright spots and blind spots, and right now it's escaping me who the woman was who wrote about this. There's an analyst who wrote a really meaningful paper about this, and I'm not remembering her name right now. I think that applies to all of us. Immigrant analysts sometimes have a sense of commonality that is illusory, you know, that we have actually quite different immigration experiences from our patients, even if we came from the same place of origin. I think the same is true for non-immigrant analysts, that sometimes, you know, we need to hold in mind what we experience as other in the other person and what kind of assumptions we're making about similarities and differences. I think also paying close attention to how the patient we're working with, what their experiences of our culture may be, and how that informs the way they're sharing themselves and the dialogue that happens is, I think, an important factor. Yes.
Well, it's funny to hear you reference our culture as immigrants. Technically, I'm the child of immigrants, which adds another layer of complexity because I'm not an immigrant myself. You know, but when you refer to our culture, is it clear what our culture is if we sitting in the therapist chair are also immigrants?
Right, exactly. I think, you know, there are all sorts of ideas that are assumptions that our patients also make about us that will inform how they feel understood by us, and whether you're an immigrant or not. So the person that that I mentioned in the book that I worked with for 6 years, he at the very end of treatment shared with me that he thought I was Jewish all along, that I'd grown up in Germany, but that I was Jewish. And it was fascinating. I had never, you know, I would have never guessed that he perceived me this way. And it led to an interesting exploration of what that meant for him, you know, to see me as a Jewish woman. So sometimes we have ideas, you know, our patients have ideas about our culture that, that are not obvious. So for example, that you are the son of immigrant parents, that I'm Greek and German at the same time and not Jewish. You know, sometimes these things are not visible. What is visible or what's audible is an accent, the particular ways we conduct ourselves, how we decorate our offices. But I think sometimes, the experience of psychoanalysis is a cultural experience too, and we need to be really mindful of how our patients, you know, how they find themselves into that, how they find themselves, you know, relating to the process of psychoanalysis and what that means for them.
Right, because psychoanalysis is a culture of its own, and it has strong roots in Jewish culture. Some people believe it's also a predominantly white culture. And I wonder what you feel about whether psychoanalysis needs to adjust some of its principles, some of the things that it takes for granted about human living and human development, in order to make space for people from different cultures who don't share those presumptions about human living.
Yeah, I think we need to be very careful about how experience gets created in the intersection of race, culture, class, language, and how that can be very, very different for us, and what we experience as a successful life. Or a meaningful life vis-a-vis, you know, our patients. I think there's a lot of, there are a lot of unwritten assumptions made about what meaningful living entails. And we really need to be very careful and examining what the desires of our patients are and what their situation actually allows. What the limitations are.
I want to talk about public perception of immigrants, and I want to do so by reading a quote from the book that from the introduction, which you wrote. I think it's a really great mm-hmm. quote, so I want to read it. You say, mm-hmm. having an interesting, varied background may have cachet at a party in the West Village, but it does not feel exciting while waiting in the immigration line at JFK as a, quote, non-resident alien, end quote, wondering whether we will be granted entry. That's you speaking.
Mm-hmm.
What are you trying to say here?
That there is something, there is a certain excitement about a sort of cultural difference and otherness that that we love, especially in places like New York City, where a lot of different cultures come together and people sort of create a vibrant, community, of different backgrounds. That's one piece, that it is exciting to meet someone, with a different accent, with a different cultural background, and just find out more. It's a whole different matter when that person actually deals with racism, uncertainties around their immigration status, with continuously being misread by others and not recognized, and the effects that has on self-experience. And there's also a big difference around what it means to be an immigrant legally and psychologically. So I was psychologically, I had immigrated a long time before I got my green card.
Mm.
And the legal status was devoid of how I felt and the symbolic notions of what it means to me to have immigrated. And so there was a sort of an encounter with the states that holds a lot of terror for a lot of recent immigrants and people who are trying to secure, their status in this country.
Yeah. So, and I'm wondering what more you can say about the psychological experience of someone, as in your case, who has been here long enough to feel as though psychologically they've immigrated, but they still haven't received their green card, or they're still on some kind of visa that expires in a year, or they still are looking for a sponsor, a job that will sponsor them. What's the experience of that person like?
There is a sense of isolation that people who are in that situation often experience. That's both for people who are undocumented, that's very heightened, and for people who are uncertain about how long they can stay in this country. There's a way of not being able to move forward and planting roots. There's this overarching uncertainty. There's also a way of not always feeling understood by employers. There's some paranoia, not just in the non-immigrant, but also in the people they encounter around the non-immigrant status. So I remember that, when I was on a student, so I'm also in a privileged situation. I think that, in comparison to people who are uneducated, not white, from developing countries or countries that are on a list of banned countries to even enter the United States at the mm-hmm. moment. That's a whole different experience, asylum seekers, refugees. But I can speak from my own experience when my student visa finished and I had to secure a job in order to have a work visa, that these negotiations with employers were really difficult because mm-hmm. it felt like what I was asking for, say, can you guarantee me that after a few years you will sponsor my green card, was something that people were reluctant. They didn't fully understand it. Was I asking too much? When in fact, I just needed to make sure that I could continue working in this country, otherwise I would have to go back. And I think that's true for many, many people who are in that situation, that they come up against a lot of not knowing, in the HR, well, especially when they're interviewing for jobs. And then it's a whole different story than interacting with the HR department of clinics, for example, or companies. And this experience of just not knowing whether someone can stay, I think it really slows down their development and their ability to plant roots and have a community.
So wait, so you're saying that in your experience, and again, I'm sure many people, many immigrants looking for work and looking for permanence here encounter this. You're saying that some of the folks that you encounter didn't even understand the procedures or didn't understand the nature of what you were asking for, the laws, the nature of the visa, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that most psychologists who apply for jobs, I'm sure it's not unique to psychology, although there are certain industries where being on a visa is so much more common. Say, you know, if you are an engineer from another country and you're working in Silicon Valley, you know, you're almost the majority. So I think they're pretty well, at least the HR departments of startup companies are pretty well versed in accommodating those visas. Mm-hmm. I haven't been in that situation, but that's my impression. But if you are, in my situation, I would certainly say it's a very common, and actually many of my patients have been in that situation too, that talking and getting hired for a job by someone who is a psychologist or is a medical doctor or is a political scientist is one story. But mm-hmm. then to actually go to the HR department and see what's possible and what they're willing to do is a whole different situation. And so there's a lot of sort of navigating and actually educating other people about, you know, what needs to happen with which timeline, what they're actually agreeing to. And that is nerve-wracking. And that really limits what kind of work people can find too.
You know, and in my experience working with immigrants and just being friends with and close to lots of immigrants, there's a certain language around the legal process of obtaining residency that you would only know if you're familiar with the immigrant experience. Like, you either know what OPT means or you don't.
Yes.
You know
yes.
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And those of us, those people who are privileged to not have to deal with any of that sort of stuff, won't know not just what any of those words mean, but what that world is like where one's status here is in limbo.
Yes, exactly. That's a whole place of consciousness onto itself that people don't choose to live in, but that they have to occupy often for long periods of time. And there's a dread that's part of it and an uncertainty the legal immigration system here is constantly in flux. It's very complicated. Often lawyers are not even certain how things are going to play out and don't consider all the different options because there's so many and things are so contradictory. So many of us have been in situations where they did not feel that they could ever find out answers for certain mm-hmm. about how things were going to go. And that in itself creates a lot of stress too.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to your quote then about this duality between possessing a certain cachet on the one hand and in certain environments, yet experiencing rejection and pushback in other moments. Would you say that this differs also by group? And especially in the current moment right
yes.
now, like that some groups are welcomed and possess a certain cachet while other immigrant groups are looked down upon and rejected. And I wonder what you have to say about how that's playing out right now.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, when every time you say the quote, I'm thinking of a New Yorker a New Yorker cover that came out, I think, a long time ago, I want to say in 2007, there are two lines in immigration. I think it's at JFK. It's a, you know, it's a cartoon. And one of them says, Euro trash. And the other one says, others, or I think US citizens, others, and Euro trash. And the Euro trash line is all these people who look very glamorous and they're drinking champagne and they're laughing. And the US one is all these, unhappy looking Americans. I don't think actually there was a third line. I made that up, the other one. There should have been. But what makes me laugh about this is that, of course, the Eurotrash people don't celebrate in line with, in this glamorous fashion. Mm-hmm. They are also afraid, but they have much less reason to be afraid than immigrants from some other countries. Many of us have been called into the interrogation room, and there it gets really interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever had, that experience.
I have not, thankfully.
Yeah, I've had it a couple of times because of confusing aspects of my visa and it's amazing sitting there and what the counter of the interrogation room is higher than the top of my head, so I think it's like 6 feet high. So these people literally look down on you. And it's designed that way. It's that way at Newark. It's that way at JFK. And the people who are sitting waiting are usually from African countries, from Arab countries, some Eastern European countries, and very few white people. And it's a very intimidating experience to sit there.
And so I wonder, that makes me think about, I think it was... I always mess up her name, Ghislaine Boulanger's chapter on multiple and often incongruent self-states that an immigrant inhabits, because I'm wondering what do you have to say about the kind of self-states that get activated in an immigrant here, especially with experiences like the one you just described when they're being treated so condescendingly. And given that many of these people in their home countries possessed a different level of respect within the community, of status, given, maybe they were professionals, how do these self-states then coexist? And does the experiences like this shape these folks' experience of selves and create new self-states in these people?
Yeah, absolutely. And contradictory ones. Exactly. So, your previous history and experience with stigma in your home country will inform how you respond to the way that people read you and respond to you in this new social context. For me, that was a positive experience because I, grew up as an immigrant kid in Germany, and it held certain assumptions at the time with my family being Greek, because mostly working class Southern Europeans came as guest workers in the 60s and 70s to Germany, and there was a certain stigma attached to that. And here I was one of the, there were certain ideas about what it meant to be a white European, a woman, educated woman, that were very different in terms of the opportunities I had and what people believed I could do, that were open doors for me and gave me a sense of my own capabilities in a different way. For my patient who I describe in the chapter, who came from a Caribbean island where he was, seen as a light skinned, but here he was seen as a black man. It was a very different experience for him. There he was upper middle class. Here he was assumed to be, assumed to not be upper middle class. There's resentment, but there's also, I think, a sense of confusion and the way that we sort of hold on to these experiences and how they play out in sort of places of confusion, depression. Sometimes it really takes a little bit of unpacking to even understand why people are feeling the way they're feeling.
And what do you find that they often trace those feelings back to?
I think they often trace feelings back to basic insecurities and injuries that may have less to do with the situational context. And then I think it can be really helpful to put that into context, literally put it into context of what their life situation is like and how their experience is of being misread by others or not read at all.
You know, changing topics a little bit, I also wanted to hear your thoughts about names and name changes. And I believe you have a chapter about that in the book as well, because you observe that a lot. Some people come to this country and leave their name intact, and others, and some cultures, I think, have more a tradition of doing this than others. Others will adopt, at least in this country, an American-sounding name, or maybe go by their middle name, which is easier to pronounce, or that sort of thing. What have you observed about the way that different immigrants handle the name issue, and what are your thoughts about it?
I think it's a fascinating thing to sort of keep in mind when we encounter a new patient and be curious about, because there's so much about sort of the family's attitude, for example, in regards to making a place for themselves in the US that can be sort of symbolized in the way they handle naming their child or changing their own name or using a particular nickname and what the function of that was. So, you know, whether someone has a Chinese name, maintains that Chinese name, changes it to a completely different English name, whether the family changed their name entirely. That happened, you know, on Ellis Island. I don't know how much that can happen now, although people can choose to change their names too.
You mean legally a person here can, after they've arrived and obtained status, can opt to change their name?
Yes, yes. Any American and any foreigner can opt to change their names. I'm not that familiar with it, but I have friends who, you know, got married and ended up, you know, kind of doing a blend of their own names, know.
But why do you think people do that, though? Why do people, what does it achieve, or what does it do for someone psychologically to change their name upon arrival?
I mean, I think it's interesting because it does symbolize a new identity, but it's also, I think we're trying to control how other people are going to perceive us, how foreign we are to them, what kind of preconceptions they may have about our place of origin, and what kind of trouble that it could cause us.
Do you think it's also a way for the person to manage their own relationship to their home country and their prior identity versus their new identity?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's something about, you know, when you choose your own name, where it can open something up. I grew up with my mom's last name, Paratioglu, which is, you know, like no one could pronounce. And I always felt way too exotic with that name. And but according to Greek law, I automatically was bestowed my father's name, my father's name is Beltsios, Beltsiou. And when I graduated from high school, they pointed out that there was this incongruency between what was in my Greek passport and what was, how I was registered at, you know, different official offices. And so I ended up changing my name to keep it more consistent with my passport at the time. And I'm really glad I did. I think it was it would have been a bureaucratic nightmare to try to change the name in my passport to Paratiroglou. But I also felt like Beltsiou was much more ambiguous. It was easier to pronounce. I did not feel as exotically different as Paratiroglou sounds in Germany.
And you didn't want to feel exotic?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I also grew up in a climate where I felt like that was stigmatized. Mm-hmm. It meant something, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe that has changed. But it had a meaning for me. And I can very much, I mean, I think also that's interesting when people choose to choose their partner's last name when they get married, or whether they choose the name mm-hmm. that they had prior to the marriage. There's an opportunity to also change something about your identity.
You know, and as in yet another interesting twist, as a therapist, I can't tell you how many times I've had a situation where I started working with a patient and understood that patient's name to be a certain name, and because that's how he or she has introduced him or herself to me, but then maybe I've submitted a claim to that person's insurance, and there's ended up being some sort of problem, and then the patient has had to inform me, oh, well, actually, no, my legal name is such, and in many cases, and I have a small sample size, but this occurs a lot among Latin folks, they are going by their middle name as their first name. Although I have a non-Latin patient with whom this has happened, but their actual first name is a different one, and that's the one that the insurance recognizes. And I should probably do a better job of investigating, well, what does it mean for them? They've not quite changed their name. They're just using a different part of their name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be interesting to find out, you know, what that means. I think I have some friends whose first names are Maria and their second name is a different name. And maybe it's a differentiator to use your middle name because it's less common. Mm-hmm. Used, I don't know, or if it's, if it has other meanings for them as well.
Julia, there's so much more in the book for us to talk about. I think that you've done such a great job bringing together a group of smart and experienced and thoughtful immigrants and analysts and authors to cover so much about the immigrant experience and all of its facets. We're almost out of time, but I don't want to end without first asking you what it is that you're working on next.
Okay, so I'm still presenting at conferences. I will present at IFPE in Fort Lauderdale. It's a conference in November. It'll be a shortened version of my chapter in the book. And then I will be on a panel at Division 39 in New Orleans, an invited panel about immigrant analysts and their personal histories. I'm working really on something different that also is research that's meat search, and it's about the fundamental identity shift that happens for parents when they become parents. So I'm reading about the different aspects of how your sense of self shifts when you become a parent and take on the role of parenting.
That's an interesting twist, and I look forward to seeing what you come up with. Before we go, though, for our listeners who might be interested in going to hear you speak, can you tell us the two conferences you're presenting at IFPE and Division 39? For those of our listeners who don't know what those are, can you tell us what those stand for or what those organizations are?
Yes. Oh, God. IFPE is the International Federation of Psychoanalytic
something.
I don't remember now. Sorry about that.
But it's in Fort Lauderdale, and when will you be there?
I will be there. It's, I think, the weekend from the 9th to the 11th of November, I believe. Yes, from the 9th to the 11th, there's a conference in Fort Lauderdale on the experience of time.
And then you will be at Division 39, which is a division of the American Psychological Association, right?
Yes. So it's the psychoanalytic division of the American Psychological Association. And they have a meeting in New Orleans the last weekend of April next year.
So anybody who wants to hear Dr. Bell to speak, you know where to find her. This has been such a great conversation, Julia. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Eugenio. It was a pleasure.
Okay, take care. This is Eugenio Duarte, your host for New Books in Psychology in New York. I hope that you enjoyed the interview that you just listened to, and I also hope that you'll keep letting me know who you would like to hear on the show next or what books in psychology you're reading. To let me know, go to my website, eugenioduartephd.com, and click on Contact. Until next time, have a great week.